You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, a hospital, you know, may not be a great place to be sick. Over 2 million people will pick up an infection in a U.S. hospital this year, and 90,000 of them will die, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Almost 70% of those infections are resistant to at least one drug. The trends toward increasing numbers of infections and increased drug resistance show no sign of slowing down. And the last line of defense, that last antibiotic we rely to work on no matter what, well, it no longer works no matter what. And as drug-resistant bacteria are evolving quickly, the pharmaceutical pipeline for new antibiotics is drying up. Over the last decades, there's been more than a 50% decline in the number of antibiotics approved each year by the FDA. And out of 506 drugs in clinical trials this year, only 6 out of 506 are new antibacterials. According to my next guest, without incentives to reinvigorate antibiotics research and development, doctors won't have the drugs they need to protect us from this growing threat. So if you've been worrying about a flu vaccine shortage, here's another potentially more troublesome healthcare issue to set your sights on while you're waiting in that line at your clinic. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to discuss how we can avoid a superbug crisis with a little help from some new drugs. How are we going to get those new drugs? Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Dr. Carl Nathan is the chair of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Weill Medical College at Cornell University in New York. He joins us today by phone from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nathan.
Hi, thank you for your interest in this problem.
Well, you know, I read your commentary in Nature this week, and it just scared the heck out of me.
Well, good. We got to get some attention to this problem and get started.
Well, why are there so few antibiotics?
Well, it's a surprise that as resistance is rising, as you just described, the number of new drugs in the pipeline is falling. And I think it's chiefly an economic problem, it's partly a regulatory problem, and it's also a scientific problem. So problems have multiple
All
causes.
Right. Let's go through the different causes with us. Number one.
Well, the business issue. Okay. The surprising thing is that people making decisions about what drug companies can go after for new medicines include a very important group who are not trained for it, they're not responsible for it, and they're not even aware they're doing it. And I'm speaking about investors. In effect, they make decisions for drug companies about what the drug companies can afford to go after. Investors demand enormous profit markups for pharmaceutical companies compared to other kinds of businesses. And it's a very competitive environment in which the companies find themselves. And they have to think about drugs that are going to sell to a large number of people over a long period of time. Problem with antibiotics is that at any given moment, fortunately, not a large number of people will need a particular one. But even more worrisome, they become no longer effective after a reasonably short period because the bacteria are so clever at developing resistance. And we've made a number of fundamental mistakes to actually encourage that rather than delay it. Mm-hmm. So the market life of an antibiotic, you know, can take 10, 20 years to make it. It can cost $800 million dollars or even twice that to develop it. But if it runs out of a useful lifespan in 5 to 10 years, it's a bad business decision. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem.
Sounded like the flu vaccine. You could have substituted a lot of that
for
flu vaccine.
It's remarkably similar. I understand that about 35 years ago, there were 26 companies making vaccines in the U.S., and now it's down to 5. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It's the same thing. Retreating
All right.
from the market.
You had factor number two.
Well, that's the regulatory problem. So if you're a drug maker and you're setting out to cover antibiotic-resistant bacteria and you go to the FDA, they don't have a category for that. You have to show that your new drug is better than existing ones against antibiotic-sensitive bacteria. And it won't be, because if the bacteria are sensitive, the antibiotics we have now are fine. If you say, well, okay, I'll do a clinical study just in people who have infections with the resistant bacteria, how are you going to find them unless they've already been treated with other antibiotics, and that's how you found out that their infections were resistant. So it's very hard to do those studies. Mm-hmm. So the companies get discouraged. I think another problem is that a great new way to find brand new kinds of antibiotics is to use different targets at the same time in bacteria. In other words, combination therapy.
So explain what that problem is, or what those targets are and how we target the bacteria.
Okay, they're usually enzymes, and the bacteria need them to carry out essential life processes while they're infecting us. But if a process in a bacterium is really important to the bacterium, it'll often have two different versions of the enzyme to do it. So if you find a chemical that inhibits one enzyme, the bacteria can cope. They can run on the backup with the other one, and vice versa. So you really need to inhibit both of them. Mm-hmm. So if you had two new drugs that together were fantastic, but individually they weren't so great, the FDA would say, no, that's not good enough. You can't make a combination until each one passes the test by itself. So that's another rule. It's, you know, it was designed to protect us, and it makes sense in a way. But in this particular setting, it's a handicap. Mm-hmm. So the companies just throw their hands up, and they say, we can't deal with this. Mm-hmm. And then there's the scientific reasons. And this, as I learned more about this, this really surprised me the most, because we have more opportunities than ever to understand the vulnerabilities of bacteria. We know their genomes now. We know the parts list, as people say. And this should be easy. But it's actually, it's paradoxical. It's the success of the industry in developing antibiotics over many years that led them to feel that there's a right way to do it, and that's to go after a very limited class of targets. And those drugs were spectacular. But the bugs have figured out how to get around that, and we need fresh approaches. So one thing we need to do is to realize that enzymes the bacteria need to survive in the test tube, some of those they also need to survive in the body, but there are other enzymes in the body that they use which are completely different, because the body is a much different biochemical environment for a bacteria to struggle in than a test tube. Mm-hmm. The oxygen concentrations can be different. The oxidative stress is different. The source of energy is different. The amount of iron, which every life form needs, is more regulated in the body. And so actually people have used modern genomic techniques to identify genes that bacteria require while they're infecting a host. And there are a lot of new genes that the traditional approach doesn't go after.
So we need a non-traditional approach.
We need new approaches. Actually, industry has pointed this out. Leaders in the industry have been publishing papers about this as far back as 1985. The idea that it's the bacterium in the host that should be studied as a target, not the bacterium happily growing in a culture medium in a test tube.
You say in your commentary, it makes no sense to use 21st century technology to develop drugs targeted at specific infections whose diagnosis is delayed by 19th century methods.
Yeah, this brings up the point that in industry, to try to get a bigger return on your investment, as well as help the doctor who's not sure what the infection is at the beginning, there's been almost a requirement that the antibiotic be broad spectrum. That means that it kills lots of different kinds of bacteria.
We call these the wonder drugs.
Wonder drugs, and so they are until the bacteria, any individual bacterium can learn how to beat it, and then they have this wonderful ability for them to share that information across species. They have little miniature viruses called plasmids that carry resistance information that can be exchanged between bacteria. So the very broad spectrum, which means wide use, translates into short lifetime for the antibiotic before a lot of bacteria know how to get around it. So obviously we could keep individual antibiotics useful longer if they were narrow spectrum. But then the doctor has to know which one to take when the patient comes in, let's say with pneumonia. You can't just throw a broad-spectrum antibiotic at somebody unless you know exactly which cause of pneumonia they have. So there's a tremendous advance on the technological side of science going on now that if we wanted to, we could turn on the problem of quick, specific, accurate diagnosis as a patient comes into, let's say, a medical center setting and probably in the future into a doctor's office.
Hmm. I'm talking with Dr. Carl Nathan about the problems in developing new antibiotics this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you're saying if we develop these new techniques that you could sit there and wait and take a half hour to get the diagnosis of what your infection is, we might be able to target more better specific antibiotics for them.
Yeah, and then there's other things we can do. We can stop feeding antibiotics to healthy farm animals. It adds a few cents per pound to not do it, but by sending half of our antibiotic output to feeding animals, the resistance spreading process is accelerated enormously. But I think we actually need a whole new approach. I think we need a new institution to make antibiotics, because the drug companies, they would love to. I mean, the individuals in the drug companies would like nothing better than to do this kind of work. They're good at it. They're motivated by a desire to help people and treat disease. And the economic and regulatory frustrations I just mentioned are very acutely felt by them. They would like a way out of this.
So what's the way out?
I think we need a not-for-profit drug company to make antibiotics in the cases where the market doesn't provide the kind of incentive that investor-regulated or driven industry demands.
But that means you need like a charity work. People have to give you money to do this.
Yeah, well, they're doing it. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been phenomenal for their vision and their generosity. And they're doing this with respect to the same problem overseas with tuberculosis and malaria in particular. I think we have to recognize that the problem that the poorer countries are having with those diseases and the problem that the richer countries are heading into with so-called routine infections, it's really the same thing. And if we don't solve it, we're going to end up with the same situation that they have there.
But what do we do if we come up with an antibiotic? We can't make it. Your nonprofit, your charity can't make the stuff. You need a drug company.
Well, I think with tax incentives and government support, the drug companies could participate. They could send their own people. I think the ones I know would love to do this on sabbatical if there was a tax write-off for doing that. They could rotate in this company and direct scientists from both academia and industry who work there in the usual way, but with this fresh kind of thinking I was talking about. And they could patent what they discover, and they could tell everybody what they've patented instead of keeping it a secret, and license it back to companies that are interested in finishing the development, making the product, and selling it. And I'd let them make a profit in the wealthy areas as long as they are willing to distribute these drugs to the poor regions on a not-for-profit basis.
How do you get this ball rolling?
It's going to take leadership, like all complicated problems, and an educated public that doesn't want to wait until the train wreck arrives.
And you think there's going to be a train wreck?
It's inevitable. Yeah. Antibiotic resistance is permanent. We need a solution. I mean, it's something that's going to always happen. We're not going to solve this problem once and then forget about it. We need a long-term, flexible, global structure to deal with this, including decisions about which diseases to make antibiotics for first that are on an organized basis. Mm-hmm. This is just not a case where random market opportunity serves society's needs.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nathan, I only got about a minute left, but is there something wrong in a society where we have to depend on charity to make antibiotics for us?
Well, we can't depend on charity very long, but charity plays a role in blazing new directions and showing us how something can work. It's like a demonstration project. But we can't rely on the Gates or the Rockefeller Foundation or UNICEF or WHO or any of these structures on a long-term basis. This is the responsibility of society as reflected in its government, working together with the drug companies. As I say, I think they would really welcome the opportunity.
We're going to come back and follow this quest that you have. I hope you're not doing a Don Quixote on us, and something might come out of this.
I hope you're right.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carl Nathan, Chair of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University here in New York. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick, Paul Masiello, and Enrico Cardi in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Finn. If you missed any of the references we made, you want to know more about antibiotics or about this new human species, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Click on Teachers. We have the free curricula made from the show, and you can download it and take it into your schools. Also, back editions of Science Friday from our archives. You can listen to them on real audio or take them with you on your iPod or Audible player. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.